Turn in your Bibles to 2 Corinthians, chapter 5. Sitting here thinking, I decided to change my message this morning because I wanted to talk about Gloria and what she's facing, and I wanted to talk about the graduates. And I decided, how can I talk about them both? And I also wanted to talk about some things that I've learned this week. And this passage seems to fit all of those requirements. Paul's writing to a church that's nothing but trouble to him. A church, and by the way, that means he enjoyed them, okay? If you don't enjoy something or someone, you can turn them right off. You can say, well, that's no problem. I just don't think about you. I mean, there's a lot of problems that are going on all over this world, horrible things that don't trouble me. If I stop and think about Bosnia, if I stop and think about what's going on in different places in Africa now, if I stop and think about some of the crises going on in the world, it would bother me, but I don't have to think about them, so they don't bother me. The things that bother us are the things that we also take pleasure in, the things we're close to. Things only bother you when they're close to you. Well, Paul was close to this church, but they were a constant source of pain to him. And here he's writing to them in the book of 2 Corinthians to talk to them about what they had done well and what they had done poorly. What they had done well was in their giving and their collection for the giving to the saints at Jerusalem. What they had done poorly was in their response to his ministry and was in some of their attitudes. And Paul was saying, but I want to let you know, I'm not discouraged. I won't be discouraged. I can't be. Chapter 4, verse 1, he said, we've received this kind of a ministry. It's a ministry that brings life. And I don't have to be like Moses. I don't have to lead the people to Sinai and then have to watch all the way through the wilderness 10,000 die here, thousands more die here, watch a whole generation perish in the wilderness. He said, I don't have that kind of ministry. I got a ministry of life. And he says, I'm not discouraged. And then as he comes to the end of chapter 4 and the beginning of chapter 5, he talks about his attitude. And one of the things that I will keep focusing you on is that there's a key towards life. And you can't do anything about your circumstances. All you can change is your attitude. All right? You don't have any idea what's going to happen to you tomorrow. Last week, I made the really dumb mistake of preaching a message about being able to handle pressure. Okay, I don't think I'm going to do that for a while. I think that I told my deacons this week I'm going to preach a message about how God will sometimes dump all kinds of money on you. You know, yeah. Because as soon as I do that, the Lord goes, okay. And I literally twice as many pressures came up this week as last week. When I preached last week, Gloria wasn't even in the hospital. None of these things that were coming about, and there's a wealth of other things out of the blue that dropped. But one of the things that I've learned, and it's so true, is you've no idea what the circumstances are, and you can't change them. And if you spend your life trying to change your circumstances, you've wasted your life. You can change your attitude. And I want to talk about how you change your attitude. In this passage, we'll start with chapter 4, all right, and in verse 16. And I first want to talk about how Paul changed his attitude, and then about what the attitude he ended up with was. He's been dealing with them about so many things, and I'm starting here. I could have started earlier, but I'm starting here because these are some things that in particular I've learned this week. Earlier, Paul had been talking about we're troubled, but we're not distressed. You know, we're persecuted, but we're not forsaken. You know, I have all these things happening to me, but my attitude isn't that way. He said, I want to let you know that what's happening to me is not changing my attitude. And how did he keep his attitude? Well, there's two sides to it. Attitude, I gave you this lecture once, I'll give you again, is a word that means what direction are you pointed. That's what attitude is. Attitude simply means what direction are you pointed. When NASA has a rocket ship go up, Sometimes you'll hear the talk between the tower and the back and forth with the controllers, because when a rocket goes up in Florida, they're controlling it from Texas, from Houston, and they talk about the attitude of the rocket. You know, what do you say? Well, it's got a bad attitude this morning, we can't go. That's not it. It's, is the rocket pointed in the right direction? Is the attitude, is it up, is it down, is it sideways, is it going this way? The attitude is what direction you're pointed. And in your life, that's what attitude is. It's what direction are you pointed? How do you take it? Are you set to receive it? If you've ever played a contact sport, any kind of contact sport, you know you can't do anything about the moment of contact. All right? Let's say football. You know that they're going to hit you. You can't do anything to stop them from hitting you. You can't say, "Now stop that." You know, there's nothing you can do. But you can set yourself. You set your attitude. You set your body position so that you're ready to receive the contact. Well, that's what life is about. And how do you set your attitude? It's what direction your head is pointed. Wherever your head goes, your body goes. First you turn your head, then you turn your body. That's a basic principle. I learned that in wrestling. When somebody got a hold of my head, the rest of me went. All right? When you want to pin a guy, you get his head down like that, and believe it or not, you move the head, and guess what? The rest of him comes along pretty soon. Paul talked about his focus, where his head was, what direction he was thinking, where he was looking in chapter 4, in the beginning of chapter 5, and then he talked about the attitude that followed it. So if you want to deal with problems, you got to get your attitude straight, and if you want your attitude straight, you got to get your head in the right place. Look what Paul says in chapter 4, verse 16. "For this cause we faint not, but though our outward man perish, yet our inward man is renewed day by day. For our light affliction, which is but for a moment, worketh for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory, while we look not at things which are seen, but things which are not seen. For the things which are seen are temporal, but the things which are not seen are eternal." A lesson I've learned this week is we spend too much time looking at the temporal stuff. We spend too much time looking at the physical, looking at the things that are right there in front of us to be seen, and not enough time looking at God's world. In fact, Pastor Hayden spent a few minutes yesterday giving me a lecture on that very point, a much needed lecture. You know, you got to turn people's eyes to the eternal. You got to point out that what's important is not what you can see, but it's where God's world is. It's the spiritual world. The battle that we're fighting is not with flesh and blood. And we've got to understand that. There are so many things that happen. Even this week, the last couple of weeks, we've seen changes going on, and continuing changes are taking place. But as a pastor, I've been telling the deacons, I praise God when we make progress in the church. And I praise God when we make changes and keep alterations going. But I'm more concerned about this congregation. You're the church. What's going on in your life is what's important. And I'm hesitant to say this, but I know God doesn't play tricks. I don't care if this building burns down. You're the church. You are what's important. The building is temporary. We're going to see that in the beginning of chapter 5. Bear that in mind. Get a good perspective. For you graduates, I tell you, you've got to understand what's temporary and what's permanent. School is temporary. And I have seen so many people lose their perspective. They ruin their lives, and they ruin their health, and they ruin their testimony over something that's temporary. For you guys that are going to college or heading off into the workforce, whatever you're doing now, let me tell you something. You better understand that's temporary. When you're a student, stay in church. I'll point to Mr. Neer back there. Amy. Cornell is a tremendously demanding place. I don't know if they offer better education, but I know they're more demanding education than most places I've ever heard of. But you could easily set church aside and say, well, I got these 4 years, and we'll concentrate on school. School's all over. You got everything you're ever going to get from that place. You probably got and a little bit less. You know, that's how colleges work. church and what you do for God is what lasts. And you guys better understand, you may leave us and go off to school, but if you walk away from God's work, you've traded the eternal for the temporal. You better start building in your life something that's going to last past school. You never think you're going to get out of the place. When you're in school, I don't care what it is. You know, I started it in kindergarten. You know, when am I going to get out of this chicken outfit? You know, I had an attitude problem there, you know. And then I got out of kindergarten. In fact, they hastened me, you know, a number of days. In fact, I seemed to get out a little earlier than the rest of the students. You know, I don't know what it was, but there was something going on there, I'm sure. Probably biblical, I'm sure. But you don't think you're going to get out of it, but it's temporary. Don't spend time and don't waste your life having concerns about something that's temporary. For our church, this building is temporary. It isn't worth a concern. It's a stewardship, and that's all. This body is temporary, but your spirit's more important. All we want are to be good stewards. We don't want to keep our focus there. Keep your eyes on what's eternal. He said, listen, this light affliction, by the way, he's talking about being beaten with a stick. He's talking about being shipwrecked. He's talking about them trying to stone him to death. He calls that a light affliction. He said, and by the way, stop and think about what the problems we've been moping over. Sometimes I wonder what we consider to be important. You know, when the deacons take me out back and beat me with sticks, then I can stand up in front of you and say, this light affliction. Until that point, I can't even say that. All right? Paul said, it's just for a moment, and you know what it does? It brings about, it's working and producing an eternal process. I got to look at that. God is using my circumstances to bring about something that's more important. And every time I forget that is when I keep my eyes on the wrong thing. And pretty soon when my eyes get in the wrong place, my attitude's in the wrong place. And I've seen it again and again and again. All it takes is a little bit of a church looking at the wrong thing, and pretty soon the church is facing in the wrong direction. Get your eyes in the right place, and that's on what is not temporal. What will last? What's eternal? He says in chapter 5, the reason we do this and we prefer the eternal over the temporal, we know that if our earthly house, that's this body, is dissolved, we have a building of God, a house not made with hands, that's eternal in the heavens. This is a week for Gloria to learn that. She's always known just how fragile her body is. Now, something's breathing for her. Something's breathing for her. Jackie was saying last night, she wrote, give me a mirror. She wanted a mirror to take a look at herself. And she said she looked at herself and her eyebrows went up. She looked around, put them back down, and said, just don't let the kids see me like this, which is very good advice, and they haven't anyways. But we don't like our outside circumstances being in a place where we look this way. We really don't like that. You know what chemo does? You lose your hair. To women, that's a terrible thing. To men, right, Gordon? We're like, hey, that's the breaks of the ball game. Okay, the bald game, I guess is what we call it. You know, that's the... But I look at it, and it's going, but I say that's what it's all about. But it's really hard when you're in bed and you're looking at yourself, and all of a sudden you've got to say, this was temporary. This thing is temporary, and it dissolves. So why am I putting all my time and energy there? And what's happening, and the thing that is so hard for Gloria is, in her case, it also involves pain and discomfort. But you guys got to learn, I have to learn, that is what this body is all about. It's to teach your soul. God keeps your soul in your body just long enough till he teaches your soul every last lesson it has to learn. Then he moves you on to the graduate academy. Okay? You're not in this body to have pleasure, to have enjoyment. You're in this body to become like Christ. And he will use the body and he'll use every physical circumstance around you for every minute until you've learned everything he wants you to learn, and then he'll bring you home. Hey, I got a body and I have compassion and concern. And if it were up to me, nobody would suffer. Nobody. Well, maybe Saddam Hussein, but the rest of the world, there are a few people that I would probably make decisions about. I am not an all-compassionate God like God is. I'm just a stupid and short-sighted human being. But I'll tell you something. God has a concern that's much greater than Gloria's physical health. His concern is her soul. And I'll tell you, it's even bigger than that. You look back at 1 Corinthians, at the Gospel of John, chapter 11. It was the sisters of Lazarus who wrote to Jesus and said, "The one whom you love is sick. You love this guy and he's sick, probably in great pain. He's dying. You love him. How come this is happening?" And then the next verse it says, "But Jesus loved Mary and Martha and Lazarus." Jesus' love wasn't just for Lazarus. It was for them too. And sometimes what you go through in your life is for other people. God does that. What Jesus went through wasn't for himself, was it? It was for us. And if we want to be Christ-like, some of the things we go through are for other people. And I'll tell you, I can see the benefits to Gloria's family of what she's going through. And they have to realize that that body is a vehicle. It's temporary. And I'm willing to get rid of it when I recognize that it's going to be dissolved. My hope isn't in this body. When I come into a situation like this, the doctor said, I'm not hopeful. So I tell the family, don't you be hopeful, in the sense that you think there's a light at the end of the tunnel. If God gives it, wonderful. But don't you sit there and demand from God that I know everything's going to turn out right and that she's going to be up and walking around again soon. Don't you dare do that. God isn't putting you in that position where you can put him in a box and say, well, if you're really God, you won't let Lazarus die. Baloney. We don't do that. You look at the other side and you say, I don't care what's happening. I look at the monitors and now you can figure out what each of them mean. You know just enough to be dangerous. You know how that is? You read them and you can see this and you get trained where, oh, that SAO2 is the blood oxygen saturation level and this. And body goes up and down, but Jesus doesn't. Jesus is what's in her body and you can't see that. They're pumping air into her, but they don't need to pump the spirit in there. And that's what's important. That's what we need to concentrate on. If the Lord raises her up, it'll be an answer to my prayers. But I'll tell you, God's already answered most of them, which is I want her heart and her spirit to be fine. I want her to rest in you. I want her close to you. I want to learn the lessons I'm supposed to learn. This earthly, and the word there, by the way, is called the tabernacle. That word is really kind of deceptive in modern English. When I think of tabernacle, I think of something fancy. You know, all the little trimmings around the outside. You know what the word means? Lean to. A little lean-to. What happened was in the Old Testament, when it came time to do the crops, you couldn't spend time going back and forth because you lived in the city, and then you went out into the fields, which is a mile or two away, and did your harvesting. Well, in the harvest time, you can't spend time going back and forth between the city where you really live and the field where you do your work. So what do? You put up a little booth, a little lean-to out there in the field, and you get up at the crack of dawn. And remember, harvest time is the time usually over there. For them, the first and the greatest harvest are between May and June, when the days are getting longer and longer and at their longest. You want to spend all the time you can to get it in, so you sleep out in the field. The tabernacle is that rotten little lean-to where you temporarily sleep and do your work before you go home. That's what your body is. It's a rotten little lean-to where you sleep and work before you go to your real home. And that's all it is. And if we can't keep that in mind, how in the world is Gloria, or by the way, Colin Smith, going to be ready to leave this one? If I spend all my time worrying and saying, Lord, give me back my health. Lord, what's going wrong with my body? I have to say, no, I'm waiting for the real thing. I'm waiting to when I go home. Hey, I don't know about you, but I'm not a big fan of camping. Some of you probably love it. I don't. They don't have bathrooms and don't have showers. All right? I can't wait. We come back, even we used to camp at a camp called Pamadiva, which was, how do I describe it? You know the woods? Okay, it's like the woods. All right, you got buildings, but the animals are in the buildings. All right, you got rain, and the rain's in the buildings. You got bathrooms, but the water all runs into the bathrooms. And so Pamadiva wasn't a really fun place to camp. Okay, it wasn't a nice campground. All right, it wasn't nice facilities. And the first thing that happened when our family came back from Pamadiva was my wife gave us the lecture. I get the shower, and you stay away from me till I've been properly showered and everything's done. Then what do? You come in and you wash your clothes. You know how you dump all the clothes in the big pile, and you find out that your kids have been keeping their dirty clothes inside that same satchel with the clean clothes, and so they all smell. So you do all that work. I want to be clean. It's like, okay, that was good for a little while, but I can't stay there for long. I want a real home. This is the rottenest, leakiest old tent you've ever been in. And what God does at the end of your life is he lets you see just how rotten, just how leaky it is. He lets you say, I got something better for you. I got something that's eternal. And he changes your perspective. You start looking up. No better place to look up when you're flat on your back. You don't have a whole lot of choices there. Notice what else Paul says. For, in verse 2 of chapter 5, in this way we groan, earnestly desiring to be clothed with our house which is from heaven, so that if we're clothed, we won't be found naked. For we that are in this tabernacle do groan because we're burdened, not that we would be unclothed, but clothed upon. He says, I'm not in a hurry to get rid of this body. I'm in a hurry to replace it. God's system is replacement. Every chapter of the Bible talks about that system. God doesn't just take something away, he replaces it with something new. If you want to get your attitude set for something new, you've got to be thinking about replacement. You can never get rid of one thing until you put something new in its place. You're never going to lift this foot up until this foot is down on the ground, right? It's that in-between stage. What do we call this? We call it falling. Okay? That's called falling. But until you do that, you can't lift this one up. It's replacement. That's what walking is. Replacing one foot with the other. What did God say? I was talking with someone this morning. When Jesus talks about the parable of the demon that lived in the house and they drove it away. And what did they do? They kept the house empty. They swept it and they cleaned it and they put it in order, but they kept it empty. Guess what happened? Replacement. Something seven times worse came in. You can't remove things in your life without replacing them. People have habits they try to break. Well, I got to tell you something. One of the keys to that is you better replace it. You're not just going to remove it. You've got to replace it. If you don't stick something else into that slot in your life, the old thing's going to come right back again. God's key towards being willing to leave this isn't simply saying, I don't want this body anymore, because you know what? It's frightening. It's frightening. None of us can approach death and not just have some fright because we're so used to it. We're so used to the old. Jesus told his disciples, his ministry was different than John the Baptist. His ministry was one of joy and light and refreshment. John the Baptist had a ministry of fasting and repentance and really heaviness and sadness. And they were looking at Jesus' ministry like, what's so different? And Jesus said, I'll tell you something. Nobody who has tasted the old right away wants the new. It takes time. You don't put old wine or new wine in old wineskins. New wine needs room to grow. You've got to have room for this new life. You go off to college, you can't just change, as it were, and leave home and leave everything. You're going to replace the things that you had at home. The question is, are you going to replace them with something good, or are you going to replace them with something bad? You go to another school, or you go into the workforce, and believe it or not, you're replacing everything you had at school. you'll replace every stress you had at school with another stress. You're not going to believe it. It's like, no, I won't do that again. Uh-uh. You've developed a habit of stress, and you'll replace the stress. You'll replace everything. Question is, are you going to put something good in there? For Gloria, she can't just desire to get out of her present situation. She has to desire to replace it with something that's better. It's not, when you leave a place, you can't just get out. You've got to be going to someplace. That's a key in the ministry, by the way. When you are in a ministry, you can't leave a ministry. You've got to go to some other place. You can't just leave. You've got to go to some place. As a church, we're growing. We can't simply say, I want to grow. We're going to have to replace things. Old things are going to have to pass away. New things are going to have to come. If you don't want to grow, then if you don't want replacement, then don't grow. When your kids grow, guess what? You have to replace all their clothes. It's really bad news. And I haven't found a way to stop them from growing. At first, I thought the key was don't feed them. You know, I figured two birds with one stone, you know. If you don't feed them, they don't grow. I need to nix that. And I worked on other schemes, and none of them work. They'll grow through sneakers. Like you, they don't even get a chance to wear their sneakers out anymore. They'll grow through shoes and everything. Churches go through replacement. As you grow, it involves replacement and turning things over. That's life. Literally, that's eternal life as well as physical life. And Paul said, that's how I get my attitude. How do I stop from looking at these temporary things? I want a replacement. I want something that's better than what I have now. It's replacement. Look at the results of that real quickly here. He says in verse 8 and verse 7, we walk by faith, not by sight. I'm saving that for a message. We are confident and willing to be absent from the body. He says, I'm confident and willing to die if I'm going to be with the Lord. There's no other way you're going to develop that confidence until you're willing to have replacement, until you've set your eyes on the eternal, until you've taken your eyes off the body and these physical, and you've seen how poor what you have now. But once you do that, you can go through it with a confidence. Every time I walk into Gloria's room, I have to have something real to hold on to. I can't go in there and be Mr. Cheerful about a situation that's tough. What the Lord will do, I got to have a confidence. I have no confidence that the physical side is going to work out. I have hope in the sense of I shouldn't say hope because that's a biblical word. I have a desire to see things be better, but I have no confidence. I got to go in there with a confidence. And my confidence is we've got something better. I've got a God who takes care of us. I've got a God who puts my eyes on other things. And I have to go in there with that. That's where my confidence comes from. Even more, he says, and this is even, I don't want to say more unique, wherefore we labor, that whether present or absent, we may be accepted of him. You know what? You get the idea sometimes that, well, if I don't care about this present world, I won't work. If all I'm looking for is heaven and what's going to come in heaven, then I don't need to spend any time or effort on what's going on here. And it's exactly the opposite. The Bible teaches that the more you want to see things new, the more you want God's plan, the more you're willing to set aside and to work in this present life because you want things to be better in the next. You're ambitious. You know you're going to have to step in front of Christ. Everything that I say, everything that you do should be done with a view towards your stepping in front of Christ. I have to answer to him for what I do. I've only got so much time. I told you a tabernacle is that place where you work and then you go home. And that's all this is. It's a place to work. And if you're not working, you've no need to be there. Isn't anybody I know who would be in that system who would say, you know, honey, I'd like to spend a couple days out there in that miserable hot sun and weather and sleep at night on the dirt. All right? Let's just do that for a little while. The only reason why you do that is because you've got work to be done. And if you have the right attitude, it's not just a confidence. The right attitude is a desire to work, an ambition to do something for God. And one last thing in verse 11. Knowing therefore the terror of the Lord. Ought to be a little bit of fear too. For you graduates, up to this point, fear has to do with pleasing the people who will graduate you. Exams, projects, whatever. But I'll tell you, you ought to have, as you approach life, if you want to keep the right attitude, you ought to have more than just a little nervousness about the Bema Seat of Christ. I've heard all kinds of explanations, but I got to tell you, that word there is terror. It is terror. It's the Greek word phobia, which is a terror that you can't deal with. It's an unexplained, not going away terror. It's not a terror that I'll be saved or not saved. That has nothing to do with that. It's a terror that I won't have used this life the way that I should. It's a fear that I have to answer for everything I do. It's remembering that you can go out and get a job. You can go out and go to college. You can do anything but stay home. You can go any direction you want to go, but you have to answer to Christ for it. You don't have to answer to mom and dad. You don't have to answer to professors or teachers, but you're going to have to answer to Christ. Every last thing I do now in this new opportunity, I do with a confidence, I do with an ambition, and that's balanced off by a little healthy fear. God always puts two things, and notice, he starts with confidence and he ends with fear. But you remember that I'm going to give an answer to you. You have to ask yourself, what in the world did you do this week that benefited God? What did you do this week that benefited Christ? What did you do this week that benefited this church and the people in this church? Because God's going to ask that question someday. When I give my students assignments, I make them do it certain times and say, okay, here's what's going to be due next week and here's what's going to be due the week after. God doesn't do it. All his assignments come due at one time. Your assignment for this week, God's going to call for it when you get to heaven. It's too late. You know what I mean? You don't know what your grade was for this week. When you get to heaven, you'll find out. And I think that some of us are going to be looking at that and saying, you know what? I didn't have the right attitude. I was so busy looking at all these temporary things and spending my time on the house, spending